welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Ollie Ray, and joined for the purposes of this intro by Miles Dacres. Hello, Miles.
Afternoon, Ollie. How are you?
I'm all right, mate. I'm all right. That was a good session. I'm feeling good after that. What do you reckon?
It was very good. It was actually one of the busiest GDPR radios we've had since we started doing them over a year ago.
Yeah, well, on that note, it's probably worth announcing that is the 50th episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, or at least the official one, because we've been running for slightly longer. But I cannot believe we've been doing this for already 50 episodes. That's pretty unbelievable, actually.
It's insane, isn't it, when you think about it? We've actually grown over 600 subscribers in the time that we've had the 50 sessions that have been recorded. So, yeah, and still growing to this day, which is amazing.
Which is amazing, and we're incredibly grateful to all of our subscribers, all of our regular listeners, all of our regular attendees. You know, we couldn't do this without any of you, so we're extremely grateful. But a good session this week, as I say, you know, fitful that it's our 50th episode, and yeah, so it's just a GDPR radio, so it's all pretty informal, pretty relaxed. We're back next week with an episode dedicated to training and awareness. Unfortunately, I'll be away, but I'm sure, Miles, you'll be able to handle Phil and Dave on that one.
I won't be so sure about that, Ollie.
Well, I'm sure you'll manage. luckily, that coincides with the launch of the new website, doesn't it? So that's something to look forward to. That's all very exciting. And then the week after that, we've just been discussing off air that we might be able to do a bit of a live episode because the three of us will be together in the office. So looking forward to that.
That would be amazing. First time in 50 episodes that we have all three of you in the same room at the same time. So yeah, definitely looking forward to that one.
So make sure you tune into that one. But for the time being, I will leave you in the very capable hands of Phil Brining, David Holmes, and myself. Stuck in and starting with our news segment. So
just before you start on Ollie, I had a catch-up call with a customer last week. In fact, this week, only week, and he said it got a request, a compensation claim for misuse of cookies from a chap called Michael Green. He said, and I was mulling it all over. And then he said, I was driving along, so I decided to listen to your podcast. And you just so happened to mention that somebody had got a cookie damages request from Michael Green. He said, and that was like a ball. I nearly crashed the car. He said, it was an amazing, you know, coincidence that you happened to be talking about it on your GDPR radio. So he said he went away and researched it and found that this chap makes a living out of raising claims. So that was just really funny talking to Alistair, was actually. And he said, you know, it was just amazing that we'd got this thing in from this person. And then you guys were talking about it on the podcast. And he just happened to listen to it.
Yeah, I saw that the other week. I think, Dave, you mentioned it, yeah, on the podcast last week.
We did, because we've actually got a client who's received a letter. I don't think it's from that fella, it's from somebody else. But in essence, there's been a bit of chat on and commentary on LinkedIn with different professionals, and some of them are trying to collate the evidence because they all seem to be structured in a very similar way, asking for very similar amounts of small value claims, but for being upset that the cookies weren't compliant and now seeking compensation. These really kind of low value kind of claims. The letter's not just you've upset me, can I have some cash? It's actually a claim letter under the civil procedure rules, so it's something you're going to have to respond to, kind of in that sense. It's not just the first point, it's actually the first stage in trying to take you to court. So there's been a few of them flying around, unfortunately.
Well, that segues really nicely into the news section, because I noticed in the news Johnson v Eastlake Community Homes, there's a judgment at the High Court for exactly this, and the High Court has ruled that it should go to the county court because of a variety of reasons. So I think there's a body of evidence now of precedent in the legal precedent. Lloyd and Google, Johnson and Eastlake.
Rolf and Veil as well with the Dominion
as well. Yeah. Which is all referring to this Dominion. And it's worth reading this because, you know, these are now our defences when we get these things in. And, you know, they're basically saying that this harm is trivial, it's in the past, you know, and therefore can be basically, well, not ignored, but you know, these claims aren't going to get very far.
What's really interesting with the Johnson versus the Eastlake Community Homes is the fact that it was a High Court action, and the High Court actually, in essence, kind of reassigned it to the small claim, saying this is nonsense, we shouldn't have it. And there's a real win. It didn't come through in the reading on Lexology, but I have read it somewhere else. There's a real win for that, because there was a claim for costs, and it was challenged, saying that actually the costs, if it's a small claims cost, sorry, if it's a small claims case that should be dealt with by the small claims, then as a defendant, we shouldn't be having to kind of argue over the costs you've incurred for sticking in the High Court if it's in the wrong route. So the courts kind of picked up on that and said, no, actually, push it back down to the small claims court, and you weigh your own costs. So it's quite a big thing to all these claims management companies that might be thinking they can kind of inflate costs and kind of drive these things through for it to be for them to have to be the burden of those costs, because the chances are nowadays, as you mentioned, the changes in the case law, this de minimis level, the recent case law and things, kind of saying you're probably making it a bit harder to actually claim compensation where it's nothing more than fanciful.
Yeah, and they're quite critical of claims firms, aren't they, in this judgment as well? The judge was quite critical of them. Again, interesting and relevant to a lot of the people we work with, because it was a housing.
Just interesting, because it said that the High Court said that the claimant firms who lay in multiple classes of action in claims of simply arising from trivial data incidents is an unacceptable approach, and that there was no evidential basis put forward to maintain that this was anything other than a one-off error. Which I found was quite interesting.
Which was really interesting. Yeah, it was. I mean, I put the link to the Lexology article that I read it in the chat here for people. It's quite good, because it's a summary of it. But you can, if you want, to go and have a look at the full judgment, which isn't long. It's about 9 pages long. I'm not sure that there's much more in it, actually, than the Lexology article in this case is actually pretty good.
No, for sure. And I think it's just further. As anybody who hasn't read the Lloyd versus Google and the Roth versus Veal, they're also quite interesting to read. Although the things like Lexology provides some kind of a brief overview and some good summary. You can't actually beat reading the case itself if you can find the time to do so.
Sorry, well, Ollie, we're marching on without you there, leaving you behind.
Listen. If I'm able to put my feet up a bit more, I'm not going to complain. All I was going to say was that you say, Dave, that it's worth reading the full judgment if you've got the time, and I was just going to joke that that's me excluded instantly from that activity. But no, it is interesting. I mean, the only thing I was going to contribute in addition to that is that really, even though we're seeing a rise in this sort of thing, it's not a new thing. I don't know if you remember this, Phil, but one of our clients. Maybe a year ago or something like that, one of our FMCG clients, it happened to them. Someone effectively tried to serve them.
It was this guy, Michael Green. It was. Same chap.
Yeah. So he's been at it for ages, but I think now it's targeting the housing sector, and there's potentially more sort of communication around it.
They're just targeting anybody, aren't
just
they?
Just randomly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the question back to you guys then really is, if you've got all these cases that we discussed today, and we're talking about the de minimis level, has the de minimis level actually been set? Would you put a finger on or a line in the sand saying this is where the de minimis level sits as a result of those case law, or is it building to that?
I don't know, to be honest, Dave, because I haven't read these in sufficient detail. Like Ollie, I've been a bit stretched for time, but I don't think I've seen anything that kind of sets it as a benchmark. Might be wrong. What do you think, Ollie, or anybody else?
No, I don't think so. But I mean, ultimately, in tortious liability, these principles already exist, right? In a lot of common law, tort law claims and precedent. So I think ultimately, sort of leaning on that, there is a level there. It probably just needs to be drawn out in these cases specifically, I'd have thought.
I was playing a bit, because I was only asking the question to kind of initiate discussion. Really. I don't think necessarily that an arbitrary line would be very helpful. It's got to be on a case by case basis, kind of an assessment of the facts. It's certainly useful to draw through what some of the case laws contains in there, looking at how the cases are decided. But I think an arbitrary line will be too restrictive, and I think it'll have to be on a case-by-case basis in that sense, looking at to what the elements would be.
Yeah. Michael makes a good point, which is, he says, but does British Airways settling out of court for their breach give these ambulance chasers hope to keep trying? Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Because ultimately, as long as there's still, you know, scope for there to be settlement out of court, you're still going to keep trying, aren't you? I think that's a perfectly valid point.
Yeah, but when was that settled?
Well, that was more than 6 months ago, wasn't it?
So things are moving on. I read something else as well, which is basically saying, you know, that we've talked about it before for our sports clients, Project Red Card, where there's 850 professional athletes who are pursuing their employers for the misuse of their personal data. You know, they basically want paying for their image rights and so on and so forth, or more, paying more for their image rights. And this article, again, Lexology was saying that the Google Lloyd case is going to probably, you know, scupper the Project Red Card, because Google Lloyd was all about, you know, you have to show damage and harm for each of the claimants. So it'd be 850 people having to demonstrate, you know, harm and distress caused by this. And if you can't get everybody on board, then if you've got a class action, then it ain't going to succeed. So conclusion, but ramblings are, British Airways was done before these recent judgments. And if people still have a go and companies decide to pay out of court, then there's still an opening, isn't there,
I'm only kind of loosely going on some of the case law. I think there was a little bit of case law, wasn't it, saying around about the costs and there was claims management companies trying to tie the costs of marketing to try and find people well, actually, you can't include those costs. So that was kind of clipping the wings of the claims management companies, because they're going to spend £1 million trying to advertise a group litigation order, and that's going to have to come out of their own pocket. That's going to have a financial bearing on it. Likewise, I think, like with the cookie policy, you're getting a lot of these low value, right? I want £300 because you've upset me. I want £700 because you've upset me, that kind of thing. I think the recent case law will certainly put that element to bed, because if you're going to do something, it's got to be through the small claims court. And you've got case law that's really kind of coming out now and coming forward with this de minimis level, saying you're going to have to prove a level of harm that's going to be acceptable to the courts, because otherwise it's just going to be thrown out because of the recent case law. And especially the level that the case law has come out. If you look at Google and Lloyd being the Supreme Court, it's not just county court determination. You're talking about quite a high court coming out with those decisions. So it's going to have some weight and some bearing.
Yeah, agreed. I think one of the interesting pieces of case law around this, I think you did mention, although it's slightly tangential, is Warren and DSG Retail. And one of the interesting things to come out of that, for those that aren't familiar, is that it addresses specifically trying to claim for misuse of private information, which is one of the avenues they've sometimes used to bring claims for data breaches. So in that
Judge Jason's comment about Emma Green.
Yeah, I saw that as well. I was going to get to it in a second. But all I was saying was that the court very helpfully set out that for a misuse of private information claim, there has to be a misuse, which means there has to be a use in the first place of personal information. You can't just claim for, you know, a personal data breach if it was nothing to do with the organisation, which is, you know, helpful and interesting. I was going to pick up on some of the chat points, actually, Phil, as you mentioned. Paul saying that their insurers have helpfully sort of forwarded an example of the cookie claim letter to advise them that it's doing the rounds. So it's good to see a degree of proactivity on that sort of thing. Jason picking up that that they've had the Michael Green one and also Emma Green. So whether there's a fast expanding family firm there at work potentially.
If it's fast extending, we'll keep an eye on indeed.com and see if they're starting to recruit people.
Yeah.
So it's just to be cheap.
It's all right. And then Steph saying that the issue comes down to the fact Lloyd tried to jump two steps in one rather than one. His view is that the ICO did not do an effective job in early 2012. Funny, Google were penalised by the FTC in the US for this, but not here. Yeah. So yeah, no, lots of interesting points in there. I don't know if anyone has any other points they want to pick up on this at all. I mean, there's a wealth to talk about, and we end up talking about it pretty much every week because seemingly there's a new and applicable development. But otherwise, actually on the Google point, I've seen that you've put something on our session plan here, Phil, that we might want to talk about in relation to the age-appropriate design code. But we can get to that in a second if there's any more on the damages issue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if everybody's of the same view, but I think it's fair enough. I think, you know, what harm is caused by, you know, these fairly trivial misuses of personal data? I think that there is no real harm, you know, and therefore they shouldn't be awarding damages through the courts, or people shouldn't be paying damages if approached directly, in my view. You know, it's different if it's, you know, there's other breaches like the sexual health clinic and that kind of stuff. That potentially does cause a lot of harm, but this kind of stuff is trivial. It is trivial.
For sure, and let's be fair, the compensation, or you're entitled to claim compensation where there is harm. It doesn't seem entitled to claim compensation for a mere infringement of the GDPR or data protection laws. There's got to be a degree of harm, hasn't there, for that to occur?
And that was interesting in this Johnson v. Eastlake, wasn't it? Because, again, they were looking for injunctive relief, you know, like, you know, we've got to investigate the process and make sure that Eastlake aren't, you know, misusing personal data and they're fully compliant. And, again, that got knocked out, didn't it? Like, well, no, that's not relevant.
No, for sure, for sure. So it's a really interesting case with all those kind of elements around it. I think, to be fair, the recent move in the case law that's come through, I think it's only fair. I think it's expected, quite frankly, to be in that sense. And it's good to see some of the case law starting to come through, because if you've been on the wrong end of some of these compensation claims and you're trying to manage the fallout and the protracted nature of it, and how the claims management companies start bombarding you, not only with compensation claims, but DSAR requests and things, the whole lot becomes a bit of a mess for managing, really. Yeah, lawyers do the fantastic job in the background, as they did with the Eastlake Community Homes in this sense, but it's still the knock-on effect of the safe claims management companies, and they start putting DSAR requests in and so on and so forth. It's got a big impact on an organisation. So therefore, you can often see why, if it's only going to cost you £500, you pay it to keep quiet, because it's going to cost you a lot more to defend it, quite frankly. Not saying that's the right approach, and I'm happy that the case law is there to defend it, but you can often see why economically, where you're kind of going, if it's such a low value, shall we just pay it to get it out of the way?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on Stuart's point, which is a little bit of on a tangent, but yeah, the ICO refreshed their guidance, their direct marketing guidance, earlier this year, I think, and they have this like table. I'm trying to find it to post it, but they have this table, and it says basically B2B unsolicited direct marketing communications do not need consent by email. So we have talked about that before, and I will find it and post it into here, because it was a useful clarification, I felt. Unfortunately, when I've searched for the ICO's direct marketing guide, Google sent me to the old version. So I'll find the new one for you.
Great, thanks, Phil. I was just reading there the link that Steph popped in the chat, and I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it, to be honest. I've had a quick browse of it, but from what I gather, essentially what the authors are contending is that the language of harm in legal cases isn't appropriate effectively for privacy claims, because it just doesn't really fit properly. I don't know if you want to come on, Steph, and talk a little bit about it, please do. But I'm not entirely sure how I feel about it at this moment in time, because it's, yeah, off the top of my head, it's definitely an interesting angle to take on this, and probably a reasonable one, but yeah, I'm not completely sure, to be honest with you.
But if it's anyway very difficult to use American definitions here, because the legal system when it comes to damages and harms is so different from what we have in the UK now these days. So I think we're looking into a completely different path that the UK is taking here, and America is not really a comparable jurisdiction anymore.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair point, Lars. Yeah,
I think the point actually that the paper tries to make, which I've taken from it, is you've got to look at what the action is trying to do. And I think this concept of ambulance chasers, I must admit, I'm slightly concerned with a lot of the language that's being used around this space. The purpose of the action was, if you look at the Google Lloyd case, The piece there was that to stop Google from doing something which was recognised as a sort of egregious breach, nothing has actually been put in place. So what are you trying to achieve? You're trying to get compensation for people. Well, no, I think that's a stupid piece. But what you're trying to do is say, well, actually, this was trying to stop this from happening, this piece of activity from happening. And there's been no component there. So you've got to look at what you're trying to achieve with the sort of guidance or the action that's put in place. And this is where, if you look at the ICO, if you actually watch the hearings, the ICO lawyer actually says that in 2012, if the current ICO were in place, they would have taken a different decision than the one not to pursue.
Yeah, no, interesting. I take your point. I think we have discussed this previously, and that there is sort of like this inherent tension in a lot of what we're talking about between, on the one hand, I guess, what is a very, very valuable, invaluable almost mechanism for individuals to effectively progress enforcement, if you like, an application of the law, and on the other hand, that being open to abuse, which is always going to be the case. And we see increasingly. So yeah, I get what you're saying, but it is difficult. I think it's probably, again, going to continue to be valuable to get increasing case law, increasing precedent around all of this, just to help us, if anything, in our interpretation of things.
Exactly, and I think the thing, Ollie, that is important in this scenario is, and it comes back, I think, to Phil's point, this is effectively, as an individual, the level of harm, the tort, has got a minimal value, therefore you won't bring the case. But when you multiply that tort over lots of individuals, somebody has then, it's a bit like the concept of, I'm old enough to remember half pennies, you know, when people used to round up the half P. You take a half pence off everybody. Is it worthwhile taking somebody to court over half a pence? Well, no, but if you've got, you know, a million people all getting taken for half a pence, that's £500,000. It's half of that, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I completely get what you're saying. But I guess that, again, that's on a case-by-case basis, I think, then probably that the risk around that language which you initially raised might be minimised in that capacity, because ultimately the facts probably do enough to clarify the situation for us. But it's an interesting one. Dave, you've been awfully quiet. I don't know if you've got anything to contribute on this.
I think it's really interesting. I think the problem is if we say everybody's harm is worth the same amount. So if you're trying to assess harm, is it in that example that Steph's just provided, not looking at anything other than just the sample example, because the figures are in my head, it's kind of saying if somebody's harm's worth half a P and you've got 500,000 people all worth half a P, that's assuming everybody's experienced the same level of harm in that sense. And I think there's certainly a move, and certainly within some elements to try and kind of say, well, if you've suffered harm, then you've got to demonstrate what your harm is, in essence, calculable to, because you can't assume everybody's harm's the same in that sense. So therefore, you are then dealing with individual cases. So you might have half a million of them, but you're dealing with every half penny in that kind of sense, and using the same analogy to kind of go, does your harm sit in line with this? Is it greater or less than this in that side of sense? But ultimately, the determination of that is still going to take a lot of time with some very clever solicitors.
Yeah.
Yes, sure. It'll also take a lot of time for someone to go through it. And that's what the Lloyd Google case effectively said, is that, you know, they didn't have a sufficient information. So they didn't know what data was being processed. They didn't know what data was being utilized. And they also didn't know when the harm was going to occur. And, you know, this is where I go back to I found the Solov paper worth a read, because it talks about the fact that, you know, data that is taken today, you might not see the impact of that until well into the future. You might not actually see the impact of it if you're unaware that that data has been processed. And this is where this extending that slightly further into the government consultation, if you start charging for DSARs, then you've got to now pay to get the information about what data is being processed about you.
Yeah, it's interesting, because then again, if you then link that back again, as I did previously, even though it's tangential to principles of talk, you then start to think about whether you could apply a remoteness test to this, but that probably doesn't work because it's not the same nature of harm that is going to occur. So yeah, no, it's really interesting. Phil, I know you've been dealing with some pecker conversations in the chat, so I've deliberately left you to that, but I don't know if you had anything to contribute on there.
I'm sorry, you know, I can't do more than one thing at once. I'm not been listening properly, sorry.
That's no, fine, don't you worry. I mean, to be fair, it's an interesting conversation that you're having on the chat about the business-to-business exemptions under PECA.
Yeah, I've got to dive off in a few minutes. I'm going to try and get this boxed off, and then I've got to go, I'm afraid.
Well, that's absolutely fine, don't you worry. So is there anything that you wanted to raise in particular this week before you do have to dive off?
No, I wanted to raise the slide, and I wanted to just – I saw in the FT yesterday something about the ICO now investigating Apple and Google over the age-appropriate design code of practice, which led me to kind of look at the letter to the ICO sent by Five Rights Foundation, which is actually interesting again, because the way that they've structured it, you know, they've got complaints against each of the 15, well, in fact, 12 of the 15 principles. But again, if you read that and you're interested in the age-appropriate design code of practice, then it's quite instructive to know how, you know, what Five Rights expectations are and why they don't believe that these things are being complied with. So again, just from a kind of academic point of view, or if you are caught by the age appropriate design code of practice, it might be worth just having a look at that.
Yeah, I did see that, and it is interesting. I've literally spent pretty much my entire week doing some age appropriate design COP work for one of our clients. And I think one of the things that stood out to me when I was reading that letter actually is at one point they make it very clear that one of their grievances is that a lot of the time the standards are taken as individual standards within the code and assessed as such rather than as a, you know, holistic statutory instrument effectively, or statutory code of practice rather. And that's quite interesting to me because I hadn't really considered it on that front, because I have gone through the process of assessing standard by standard. And obviously there is overlap and you do link them back together, but, you know, there is quite, that is quite interesting to me. Dave, I don't know if you saw this, but
I haven't. I've got to admit, I bow to your greater knowledge on ADCOP. I've not had a lot of involvement recently with it. So it's I'll certainly be looking at the link to the FT and kind of going through that element of it.
No, if you're relying on me, we're in deep trouble, because my knowledge is not not that great on it. Well, I'll tell you what, Phil, if you have to dive off, and that's everything you wanted to cover this week, I suggest perhaps that we move on to our new feature for these sessions. I didn't announce at the start because I wanted it to be a bit of a surprise. We've decided to formalise something which has been a feature of our sessions. Regular listeners will know that our very own David Holmes does occasionally like to get up on his soapbox. So we thought that we'd actually formalise this and give him a space.
I'm going to have to look at this recording later. I shall leave you to it. Have a nice to everybody. Make sure it's not more than 25 minutes.
I'll try my best,
catch
Bill.
You later. Yeah, have a good weekend, everyone.
Yeah. Cheers, Bill. Thank you.
So on that note, Dave, what are you on your soapbox about this week?
Well, it's a I should really start putting a forward agenda out like we do with our GDPR radios and discussion points, and it may be of interest to see things that regularly kind of start winding me up slightly. But the thing that kind of got me this week was in essence KPIs, in that sense, key performance indicators, and it's the with some of my clients it's coming around to report writing time on the level of the compliance and things like this. And I was going through some of their KPIs and kind of saying, well, what KPIs do we report to ARC, so Audit and Risk Committee, what kind of KPIs report to board and things like this. And they gave me a range of KPIs. And I thought, well, that's a start. Let's have a look at some of those. And what got me on my soapbox really about these is whether people actually understand what the KPIs are meant to be doing. So I'll just give you an example. I'm not going to name any particular kind of client because that would be awfully unfair. But for example, if you're reporting up to board or to ARC or so on, that we've had, say, this quarter as a quarterly report from a DPO or whoever's kind of looking after that function, that we've had 3 DSARs. Well, what the heck's that telling you? You know what I mean? I might be missing the point slightly, but what does that tell you? I'm kind of, because I'm a details person, that's probably doesn't help, and I maybe should have kind of led in with that. And when I was back many moons ago, when I was in direct marketing, and you kind of pull bits and pieces apart, you kind of think, well, if you're logging something, or you're noting something, or you're recording something, it must be for a given purpose. What you're actually trying to achieve. Now, I'm not saying volume-rated KPIs aren't necessary. You may have volume-rated KPIs like the number of details received. That's suitable for the governance team, for example, because it may help with deciding resources. So if you're flooded with details and so on, then it might be applicable to work through that side of things. And then there might be appropriate data-related KPIs that you might have for that purpose and to demonstrate that. But what would board say if you said to the board, we've got 3 DSARs this quarter? Well, my response would be, so what? It doesn't tell me anything. It doesn't tell me whether your process with DSARs or DPIAs or whatever else you're monitoring is actually effective and working. It just tells me that you've had 3. It doesn't tell me that your DSARs are complex, that you've used the extension. It doesn't tell me that we're late because we didn't recognise it as a DSAR. And so on. So it's kind of that element, really. That's kind of, yes, you've got volume reporting stats or metrics that might be relevant at some elements, but what are we actually trying to deliver by that, and what are we actually trying to achieve by that? Because I sometimes see KPIs for reporting purposes and in essence think, well, so what does that actually mean? What's that meant to do? What am I meant to do with that information? What does it tell me? That kind of thing. So it's just a little bit of a soapbox moment this morning, well, lunchtime really, isn't it? Just around KPIs and reporting. I don't know if you've come across any, so I can start trying to back my way off my little pedestal in that sense, or where you've come across something similar, or whether it's maybe just me that it irritates. But it's I've had the so what moment quite a few times for looking at some basic KPIs recently.
Yeah, no, I have seen them in the news. I mean, generally, whenever I've been confronted with them, it's as an assurance an assurance mechanism rather for board more than anything else. I get what you're saying, and I do agree with you to an extent, but I'm not certainly not opposed to them, which is not what you're saying, and I take your point. But so really, I guess what you're saying is that please use KPIs, but if you're going to use them, make sure they're properly calibrated, right?
Well, they kind of are they relevant to the audience that you're aiming them at? So there might be an audience that kind of just knowing that you've received 3 this month or 5 that month or whatever it is might be relevant. But to some individuals, like you said, you get this kind of so what factor. You say, I'm here to listen to you about reporting about your debt protection landscape. Let's move on from DSARs. Let's choose a different KPI. You've done 3 DPIAs this month. Well, what does that tell me? It doesn't tell me whether they're high risk. It doesn't tell me whether they're low risk. It doesn't tell me what the net score or the gross score of the risk calculation was. It doesn't even, you know what I mean? What we actually, it's just, like I said, I'm probably on my soapbox a bit too much, but it's just the point of being a bit of a so what. What are you actually trying to tell me when you give me just a straight volume figure in that sense? And it's just trying to take it to the next step. You're not telling me that your DPIAs have been open for 6 weeks in that sense. You've not told me that your DPIAs are under review or maintained in any sense. You know what I mean, in that kind of sense? And it's sometimes just looking at, well, what are we actually trying to achieve? And the reporting side of things, are we bearing in mind the audience that those figures are being reported to? And do we need to draw out some more of those examples? And just from a very case in point, I was looking at some, again, going back to DSARs, unfortunately, I was looking at some reporting of DSARs that said this month we've had so many DSARs, and 47% of those DSARs came from complaints. And I suddenly thought, brilliant, that certainly helps, because you can start putting measures around, well, how do we reduce complaints if 47% of all our DSARs this month has come from a complaint? And then whether we need to kind of break that down a little bit further. Was it a complaint as in the complaints process, or was it a complaint about data handling in that sense? And it just allows you to play around with a little bit with the figures a little bit more. So if you're thinking, well, if 47% of the DSARs came through the complaints process, then surely by tightening up the complaints process and looking at that element might reduce that 47%, and consequently that will have an impact on business efficiencies, because it allows you to do what you're meant to be doing instead of being bogged down with details. And it's that kind of detail that for some audiences I find is really, really relevant in that sense.
Well, I think it's a fair point, albeit made very passionately. Ian Garrett agrees with you in terms of basically adding greater information and context to your KPIs. What's interesting is people do generally seem to agree with you, albeit seemingly one of the keys for them around this reporting is a resourcing issue, in that if, particularly around DSARs, if they're seeing an increase, then obviously they're going to have to divert some resources, which is fair enough. And I don't think what you're saying is that that's problematic in any way, but that maybe those KPIs and the information that they carry could be further, you know, maximised in terms of their value, right?
For sure. If there's a problem with resourcing, then can we demonstrate that? Just a straight volume figure doesn't necessarily tell the reader that there's a problem with resourcing. You might have had 15 DSARs, but it doesn't say there's a problem with resourcing. If you've got 15 DSARs and that is a problem with resourcing, then why? Is it because you've got so many that are now late and you've got them tripping over and you're getting them piling up because you just can't process them? You're going to have to put some details behind it to make sense of a straight volume figure. Like I said, to some audiences, it may make perfect sense, but I just think from my point, if you want me to do something with the figure, you're going to have to tell me what the problem is with that figure in that sense.
For sure. Rick's making an interesting point that you could use the NHS toolkit audit requirements, which I'm not as familiar with, to my shame, but I will take your word for it, Rick. And Steph saying that KPIs always go back to the following quote, which is, some individuals use statistics as a drunk man uses lampposts for support rather than for illumination. Data should drive insight that then drives action. Too many, quote unquote, stroke my ego metrics. Yes, very much agreed, Steph. And I like that quote. I've not heard it before. So is there anything else to say on the point of KPIs, Dave? I know you've said your piece, but really, in terms of any recommendations going forwards, is there anything in particular that you would target? And also, I guess this is potentially too broad a question, but maybe what are some of the best, I know you mentioned a second ago in terms of SARS related complaints, but what are some of the best KPI metrics that you've seen? Might have to be sector specific, but you know, is there anything in particular that you've seen previously? Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
To answer the first part first, not really. I see a lot of volume reporting statistics. Like I say, you can break it down to the audience. You kind of go in, as I mentioned earlier, to some particular, if you're kind of looking at your team and how your team's managing, then certainly from a resourcing point, you can kind of, if you put appropriate metrics around stuff, then you can work out the impact of those metrics in that sense. So if you know your team's capable of running 3 DSARs, but you suddenly had 8, then you know there's a business impact, and reporting at that level's fine. But I just generally say, and I think it's partly the soapbox moments come from, because it's just getting to the point that I'm just seeing too many kind of volume reported statistics that's reported, but without any kind of other detail or any explanation or why is that volume either important or not important. With your ass-shocking egos going, look, this is how good we are. Actually, you're just saying, actually, from a KPI point, what we're trying to demonstrate is whether the DP landscape is effective and if it's working. And if that's your focus, then we should be bringing through requirements that kind of support that. So in essence, an advice would be then would be is do your KPIs do what you want them to do, and is it are the reporting of them and the detail that you're requiring relevant to the audience that you're aiming the KPIs at in that sense?
And I think it's also important with KPIs that you really need to have the clarity, because it's an indicator of performance. So you need to indicate or have a clarity what is actually the performance or the targets or the objectives that you want to fulfill in that. And I'm totally there with David that absolute figures. I normally report absolute figures, but not as part of the KPIs, but more as a introductional element. And then if you're doing the analysis, for example, if you're doing data subject access requests per customers, because then you can see, okay, we had normally 10, now we have 20, but we also doubled our customer base. So is that anything that should concern us or not? Because there's actually not a change in trend. But if you report just we have doubled our numbers of data subject access requests, then people draw the wrong conclusions from that. And I'm also very much in favor of performances like that you're saying, okay, we set the target that a data subject request should be fulfilled, not necessarily, of course, within 30 days, but we would like to have them out of the pipeline in 10 days. So then you can build a matrix and say, what's the percentage you have reached the 10 days? in which times you have stayed under the 30 and in how many you needed to ask for an extension. So then that is telling a story rather than, as David was saying, if you're just throwing blunt numbers around, that is not really helping anybody to monitor anything.
I would fully agree with you there, and thanks for backing me up on that one, Lars. I think you've raised some very valid points. In fact, it's not just looking at whether things as we've discussed there, but even looking at whether you've got internal SLAs in place as to what should be achieved and when, whether that's DSARs, whether that's DPIAs. You may say actually as an internal measure, all risk assessments should be open and closed within 4 weeks, for example. So you've then got a measure to demonstrate whether that element's working or not. So you've certainly hit on some additional and very valuable points there, Lars.
Yeah, very much agree. And I was going to do so just a second ago, but I was looking for my own mute button, so I do apologise. Absolutely agree with you, David. It is interesting to talk about because, you know, we do fall into these traps occasionally if we're not vigilant. And it can be easy to sort of, be lulled into complacency almost, I guess, with this sort of thing, I suppose.
You can, and also what's not always easy is if a client reports such figures to you to turn around and go, so what?
Yeah.
as a test, we've had this, yeah, so what? You know what I mean? That's not always easy to do either. Tongue in cheek. I don't suggest you do that, but tongue in cheek.
No, I'll leave that to you, to be honest, mate. I I don't tend to take that approach. I've got a couple of other bits on our plan here because we've got about 15 minutes, and I know that a listener got in touch with us and was asking about information asset registers, data quality, and records management generally. Now that is something we have spoken about a lot before. I'm currently embroiled on one front at least in a big task to map out essentially all the processing activities of an organization and build their ROPAs, although I am being helped in that significantly by some of our wonderful support desk team. But I thought it was probably just worth having a word on the topic generally of records management, Dave. And probably to start that off is whether actually there's anything that gets you go up in relation to that, because I'm sure there almost certainly will be.
Well, I will, but I can't keep bringing the soapbox out every half hour, can I? So I'm going to have to be careful.
No.
For next week's topic, I'll think about it and I'll see if there's an issue. And undoubtedly, because it usually is, that will get me going. But I think it's a relevant point that was raised, because the three are, like you say, the information asset register, data quality, records management. They're all quite specific areas that I come across, and no doubt you come across with some of your clients as well. So if you're looking at things like data quality, for example, which can feed into records management, you're looking at data quality. I sometimes find, and again, going back to my days in direct marketing and the charity sector, for anybody who's listening from the charity sector, data quality sometimes can let itself go a little bit where, or even probably a bit more than that, but it can let itself go where you've got markers against the CRM system or flags against the CRM system that people don't understand, or they were put there because there's no control measures around them. So, for example, and just use as a pure example, it's not relating to any particular charity clients at all, but if you've got a do not contact flag on the database when you're looking at data quality, it may be a relevant flag. I'm not even saying that the quality is inaccurate, to be fair, but what does that actually mean as a marker against the record? Does it mean somebody's unsubscribed to direct marketing? Does it mean that the individual's actually fallen out with the organisation and the organisation said, well, best not contact them because we're going to be poking a hornet's nest in that kind of sense, so we'll just let it be? Is it because somebody else is actually trying to, this is a fundraising aspect, is somebody else in essence trying to work with a segment of data to introduce them to a different type of ask, whether that's a major donor program or so on in that sense? But it's trying to make sure from a quality point, not just whether the data is accurate or inaccurate, but how are we actually using the data, and are we limiting ourselves in that sense, and have we got control measures and appropriate safeguards in place to make sure that we're not doing stuff to data that doesn't make sense to anybody else. So then you're kind of watering down the ability to use data effectively in that sense.
Yeah, it's a very good point, actually. One of the number one things I come up against when I deal with information asset registers, and you know, it does happen, is that they're actually just not understood as a tool. There's a lack of understanding around what the purpose of an information asset register is, what it is in and of itself, why we might compile one, why we might maintain one. And then when you start to introduce the concept of records processing activities, Article 30, ROPAs into it, then it can get really quite confusing if you're not entirely sure. And I've seen a lot of instances where, you know, it's, oh, well, we've got a really comprehensive information asset register, but we haven't got any ROPAs in place. And you sort of say, well, you've sort of got this slightly wrong. You know, you've got this the wrong way around almost. And arguably, an information asset register, from my experience, and I'm happy for anyone to challenge this, is a far more difficult beast to tackle than ROPAs, I found.
To be fair, I always start from the point, if somebody says they've got an information asset register, I normally ask them, well, what is it? I mean, I know what an information asset register is, but what is it? What are you recording on there? How are you using it? Because I often find people calling them an information asset register, but what they're actually meaning is the ROPA, that sense. So you look at, let's say an organisation said, this is our information asset register. You look, and this is my interpretation as well. I'm going to have to be like Ollie challenged on this. But you look at somebody's information asset register and it's only got personal data related activities on there. Whereas arguably an information asset register from a records management point, in that sense, could be a lot wider than personal data. It could have founding documents on it. It could have key contracts on it. It could have some other documents that's of value, of an asset to the organisation, monetary or otherwise, that held centrally, retained, understood and managed through an information asset register would be of benefit to an organisation. You think about those organisations that might possibly be caught by FOIA or the Environment Information Regulations and so on, might have an appropriate information asset register in place that's of real value. You only have to think of looking at, and it's an awful incident, but you're looking at things like cladding on buildings such as Grenfell and stuff, and just being able to have that information to hand and understood where it is and retained, and accessibility and things. That's to me where the value of an information asset register comes in that sense. So I often start when people raise information asset registers with me is, well, do you actually mean a ROPA in that sense? Are we looking at the Article 30 conditions, or are you actually trying to log and manage information that may be wider than just personal data?
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, because we, well, at least our support desk team anyway, very, very regularly get asked to review both information asset registers and ROPAs. And actually, if you're presented one of these things out of context, you sort of go, well, what are you trying to achieve with this document? It's as you say, you know, if what are you actually using it for? Because we see instances where, as you quite rightly say, an information asset register only contains activities or assets which are involved in personal data. Well, then that's probably not a comprehensive asset register, is it? Let's be honest. So, yeah, you really have to think about what you're actually trying to achieve before you set out and compile these. I think Michael makes a really great point, and I'm sure we can all relate to this, which is that one of the biggest frustrations with these types of registers, whether it's information asset or records processing activities, is that they're just not maintained. They're not updated.
Why do you think that is? And I'd be interested to see what Michael's point of this. Why do you think that they're not maintained and not updated? Is that because they're managed centrally by an individual, let's say, just randomly, let's say it's an information governance lead that's meant to maintain all of these documents across the organisation? Or do you think it's because it's not being pushed out to representatives to maintain their own part? Is it because there's insufficient training and understanding? Or is it just the fact that it's a complicated document? It's not on some kind of electronic platform that may offer some assistance with the ease of interpretation and adding details to it. So I'm interested. I get the point. I absolutely get the point that it's a massive frustration. But why aren't they maintained? Why aren't they updated?
I think for my experience of this is trying it, and I've been trying this the last 2 years of my organisation, is for this actually to be introduced into people's standard operating procedures. They see it as an information governance, data protection task. when in fact we're collating this information. You can imagine within our organisation the amount of data flows and the amount of information assets we have, and we do, you know, provide assistance to the asset owners. So any changes in data flows or any changes in information assets, we have to prompt them every time. They don't see it as something that they need to maintain and check. And we actually do have an electronic system in place that prompts them. They just ignore it as they would mandatory training. It's they're always too busy. This is not seen as a critical piece of work for them. So yeah, it's a culture thing, and we keep trying, and we keep getting these NCs audits, and we then, you know, go through and help them fix it. But yeah, it just doesn't sit on our agenda as a really important piece of work. Unfortunately, it is seen that we should be doing it for them. It's bizarre.
And would you? I'm not saying it's the right approach. I'm only saying this again just to kind of further the conversation and get people engaged with bits and pieces. But would you see the information asset owners having relevant responsibilities submitted in a job district within their JD, within their job description, and then held to account for that, and then that becoming part of their annual cyclical kind of review process, that, well, you're not maintaining this part of your job role, and therefore we need to focus on the reasons for that. Would you see that getting traction? Would you see that getting a lot of pushback going, well, that's a bit of a stick, not a carrot?
I think we initially tried that approach. What we tried to do was to make it a department's approach. So, for instance, you know, it is the head of IT's responsibility to keep this maintained, but it doesn't necessarily mean he's the person that has to do the work. What we're looking for is that connection that when, you know, we have things like change control, both for data flows and for new information assets. What we're trying to do is to get that joined up. So actually, when they make a change to a service provider or, an SFTP server, that then gets logged as part of the information asset register. And it's that bit of joining up. They're just doing the job. They're doing the ticket, and it's just seen as an extra burden on them. And, you know, we do provide them training on this. God, do we give them training? But, yeah, I think it's just, they see it as unnecessary work, unnecessary bureaucracy.
Yeah, agreed, Michael. I completely take your point. And I think it echoes my feeling on it, which also is what Christina's saying in the chat, which is that generally there's a lack of understanding of A, what this is, and B, what its intrinsic value is. I'd also just wanted to pick up on what Jason's saying in the chat, because it's given me nightmares already, which is that he's saying that they're always playing catch up. And for instance, they appointed 74 new processes last month, and someone now has to update the ROPA. And yeah, that's deeply upsetting.
I think we had a similar number last month, and each of these processes is picked up on the DPIA. As I was saying before about change control, we're already collecting this information. It's already there. It's just then that being transposed easily into the relevant registers. There just doesn't seem to be a cultural connect at all.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, the issue is that, or at least the issue that I've seen in certain organisations, is that there is then a tendency to say, well, this is an issue, so let's go out and buy a piece of kit that does some of the work for us. We'll buy a nice new fancy product to, you know, we can enter all of our information and maintain it in there. And sometimes that has the opposite effect, because the piece of kit in and of itself is complicated and people don't know how to work it. And then maybe it's one person in the organization who uses it, and that doesn't get, you know, passed down to anyone else, and they leave the business, and all of a sudden you've got a piece of kit that no one knows how to use.
Well, I would agree there's that, and there's all the hybrid with what Michael's saying. So I've also seen either the way where organisations have the bit of kit, but people still out logging in and using it to make the update. So it's, I've seen both exactly what Michael's saying and what you're saying, but that there's you've got this crossover where even with a bit of kit, if culturally it's not there and the links aren't there and the importance to take this piece of work isn't there. I know it's a bit of bureaucracy and paper chasing, but if it's not there, then regardless of the kit that you're using, it still won't be processed and it still won't be followed.
Yeah, but to be fair, you know, having said that, the degree to which automation is now accessible and, you know, easy in some instances, if you're looking at something like some of the stuff that interacts with Office 365 tenancies in particular and stuff like Power BI, like, you know, the tools you have at your disposal there for automation and making these things efficient and quick, it is something definitely to keep an eye on and look into. And it can only help in that respect, because I think that's a slightly different issue than just having a separate platform. A banner has popped up at the top of my screen telling us that we've got 5 minutes left, which is very helpful. Although just on this point, Ian Garrett asks a question, which is a register necessary? If the relevant data is in DPIAs, is that enough? Yeah, I get what you're saying, Ian. I've had that question put to me before. Where do we need to hold this information? Do we need to hold it? Do we need to actually compile it all into one place? If it's readily available in smaller parcels in different areas, is that sufficient? I think my view is that as long as you can dial it up easily and, you know, efficiently, then I don't really have an issue with it being, you know, not necessarily centralized. I don't know what your view is, Dave.
I just think if you're talking about the ROPA element of it, then it's got to be in, you've got to be able to demonstrate that should it be requested by the ICO or the regulators, or however you want it to look and feel, you've got to be able to represent it. I think if it's hidden within a various range of different documents, again, as long as you can represent that, you're going to have somewhere to demonstrate that you meet the requirements of Article 30, either as a controller or as a processor, and be able to evidence that, unfortunately, because that's what the requirements are as they currently stand. How you do that, again, you've probably got a little bit of freedom around it and the level of the detail that you're recording in there. I would have thought, though, if you've got various bits of information sat across various different bits of DPIAs, it makes it harder potentially to have kind of an oversight of it all in that sense, because it's without reading the detail within each DPIA, you maybe would miss elements of what's going on and the so on and so forth. So I think the DPIA probably has some value there. But.
Yeah, I'm back, Ollie. My call finished. I agree with Dave, but Steph makes a really good point. I was itching to jump in to say that the ROPAs is, you know, these the registers are just a collection of records. And ideally, you know, this is my rotated view of it all. The ROPA is just a report. So, you know, the ROPA is pulling together information from other sources potentially. And, you know, I agree with you. You know, ideally, have an integrated system where the ROPAs are pushing information out to privacy information. And, you know, a row on a ROPA is pulling retention from a retention schedule and recipients from the processors and, you know, sharing registers. So registers aren't mandatory apart from ROPAs. But we've seen them structured not like a register as well, haven't we, in various other places? But they're useful to see the overview. I need to go back and revisit the our data-wise, because, you know, if we could get a really good governance management system, which, you know, where you click a push a button and the ROPAs get compiled dynamically from current information across all the records, and that really, I think, is where I'd like to get to as a bit of a holy grail.
Does it not always already say that it needs to be readily available? So probably if you can get all your information together within hours, then that is probably enough if you ever get asked by the ICO to provide this information. But if you're saying readily available is within 30 days, then the ICO might see that differently.
Yeah, I don't think they're ever going to bang on your door and say, show us your ROPAs. I think it's going to be a letter, isn't it?
Yeah, but I agree, Lars. You know, ultimately, as long as you're able to dial that up with, as I say, a relative degree of efficiency, I think that's probably the key, isn't it? I do agree with Steph's point, although potentially slightly rose-tinted from the experiences that I've had, which is that ideally your ROPAs and privacy notices should be, you know, intrinsically linked and feeding, well, maybe not one another, but at least, your ROPA feeding your privacy notices, if possible, but...
I tend to see it just in my head, and again, I'm not necessarily saying this is the right way to see it, but I often see that the ROPA is a central cog from which other cogs spin off from it. So in that sense, if you're up as your central cog, then a cog coming off that would be a privacy notices. A cog coming off your offers, and then not just your privacy notice, but it could be your DPIAs, it could be risk assessments, and so on, because of how it's all kind of integrated and one bit moves another bit, if that kind of makes sense. And that's how I kind of see it. So your offer becomes your kind of your central cog that everything then spins off from.
For sure. And just to clarify, Steph did say ideally. I wouldn't want to put words in his mouth. So we're pretty much at the end of our allocated slot here. So, Phil, you're back with us now. But, Dave, also, is there anything else for this week that you either desperately wanted to cover?
Not for me, Ollie. I don't know what you talked about, but I'll listen back to recording. But it looks like from the chat, it's been quite a good interactive session. Somebody wanted to talk about IARs, which hopefully you have done, and a couple of other points that came up. Did you manage to cover those off?
Yeah, well, this is how this all started, is that we started talking about information asset registers, and that's sort of naturally led us on to ROPAs, I guess, but also broader records management themes. Good conversation and some excellent interaction in the chat. Dave, anything before we adjourn?
Not from me, no. It's again, if anybody's got any topics and would like us to discuss points, or even could suggest anything that I might want to get my soapbox about, please do fire them across and we'll add them to the mix.
There is absolutely no way that you need more topics to rant about. I simply do not believe that you are dependent on people to get in touch about that. Although you are quite right that if there's anything in particular that we haven't covered here today, and that you'd like us to talk about, please do get in touch and let us know. We're happy to prattle on about anything, quite frankly. So thank you very much, Phil. Thank you very much, Dave, for your time. It's always great to catch up and have a bit of a chat. Thank you to everyone on the session. It was a really good one this week. I felt plenty of interaction. That's always the best way for it. And if there is anything else to say, we'll cover it next week. We're back with a themed episode next week. We're talking training and awareness, I believe. I think the invites went out just a minute ago from Miles. So if you've got that, then we'll be excited to see you there. If you haven't got one, do reach out to Miles. I'm sure he can arrange that for you. And if not, we hope to see you soon. Have a lovely weekend.
Thank you very much. Have a good weekend, everyone.
Yes, for sure. Take care, everybody. All the best.
Bye.
Thanks all. Bye.
Thank you.